Monday Night Travel on Nightlife.
Yes, well, we're all stuck, of course, and can't really go anywhere, can we? So we thought we'd retrace some of the great journeys of history. You're about to hear the story of Ibn Battuta, a Muslim Moroccan scholar and explorer who explored the Muslim world and some of the countries beyond it in the 14th century. He went all over the place. He picked up and discarded a number of wives in Africa, got into trouble in India, found the Maldives difficult to leave. Our guest and guide tonight is Pamela Watson, a traveller and explorer herself, who was so taken with the story of Ibn Battuta that in the early 1990s, she hit the road and rode a bicycle across some of the parts of Africa where Battuta had travelled 600 years before. Her wandering spirit has her currently holed up in Perth, but she's joined us on Nightlife tonight to tell us the story of this 14th century traveller. Pamela, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to talk with you as well. When we think of the great travellers of this era, I mean, a lot of us would think of Marco Polo. But there were many who travelled even further than Marco Polo in his adventures. Ibn Battuta was probably one of them. What country was he from? And tell us a bit about him.
Ibn Battuta was from Tangier in Fez. And at the age of 21, in 1325, he set off on his travels. And he travelled for 29 years. He travelled 140,000 kilometres, three times as far as Marco Polo, and he travelled to over 40 of today's countries. So he really is considered the greatest traveller of his age.
Yes. Yes, much more than Marco Polo. That's true. They mainly explored Muslim countries, although that gave him enormous scope at the time, didn't it?
It sure did. The Dar al-Islam, the Islamic world, as it was called, stretched enormously. It included North Africa, it included Spain, down into West Africa. The Malian Empire was Islamic. The Indian Ocean was controlled by Muslim traders, so the east coast of Africa was peppered with Muslim trading cities. And then right through, of course, the Middle East, but then through Eurasia, into Pakistan, into the Sultanate of Delhi, that was Muslim. Malaysia was Muslim. Myanmar was Muslim. So, it was a huge world that he had to explore.
He travelled all the way from current-day Morocco, Fez, to Malaysia.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And north and south as well. I mean, he really had a really wandering journey over those 29 years. And he was working as well as travelling. And so he had to, and he got, stopped by various incidents and had to cut back and change his route. So, it was a very nomadic.
How do we know about his travels? Did he publish them?
Yes. He didn't keep a diary, but when he returned to Fez, which was the capital of Morocco, the Sultan of Morocco commanded him that he should write his memoirs, and he appointed a scribe, Ibn Juzay, to take down the record of his journey. And what the Sultan wanted was that he hear about the wondrous places that he'd visited, that he should include the events that had stayed in his mind, that he should include the leaders that he had met and the holy men that he'd met. And that is what Ibn Battuta did. He sat with Ibn Juzay and he dictated his memoirs. And it's called, it's known to us as the Rila, but actually Rila means the journey, and it's kind of like talking about the genre. It's travel literature. Mm. It's a remarkable record, but it was only translated into English for the first time in the 19th century, and the full translation was only completed in 1994. So this is a reason why many people have never heard of Ibn Battuta.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, I hadn't heard of him either. That's right, he would be perhaps the greatest solo traveller of all time.
I think so. certainly of that particular period.
Mm.
He started off by just wanting to do the Hajj. And I think of him as a bit of a gap year.
This is the trip to Mecca, of course, yeah.
Exactly. I think he was a bit of a gap year traveller. He went by himself, he got a donkey, told his family he was off to do the Hajj, and he went across North Africa. And he had a terrible time. He was harassed by bandits, he joined a caravan, he got very ill, had to tie himself to the donkey so that he didn't fall off. But when he got to Alexandria and to some lodgings, he was announced on his arrival as the judge. And he took this as a sign that it was Allah's will that he should study and become an Islamic scholar. And that is what he did. And he became a qadi, an Islamic judge. And that is how he made his living through his travels.
Oh, I see. Okay. So he was a kind of a wandering judge for hire.
Yeah, sort of like that. And then he tried to get to Mecca. And he travelled down the Nile and he went over to the Red Sea to get a boat. And I think like many people who perhaps have travelled in Egypt would relate to the fact that he got there and there were no boats running. So he had to turn around and come back to Alexandria without having actually been to Mecca. And he had a dream that night that he got back to Alexandria. And his dream was that this huge bird carried him in its wings, and it took him to Yemen and then on to Mecca, and then it kept going and he travelled to faraway places. And in the morning he related it to a holy man, and the holy man said to him, Ibn Battuta, you love travel, don't you? And Ibn Battuta said, yes. And he said, well, this dream means that you are going to travel far, you will travel as far as India. And Ibn Battuta took this as a sign, probably he wanted to do it anyway. But that is actually the spark of what changed from just being the Hajj, but to being a way of life where he travelled the world.
How did he get to India?
Eventually, when he did go to India, he went across Asia. He went through today's Afghanistan, through Pakistan and into Delhi. So it was land travel. It was a combination of walking and camels. There wasn't any boat travel involved in getting to India, but he did do boat travel to other destinations.
Yes, and now when he gets to India, he gets a job with the Sultan of Delhi.
Correct, yes.
And this leads to a great number of adventures, including he sent by the Sultan on a trip to China, of all places.
Yes, well, he was 7 years in Delhi in the employ of the Sultan as a judge, and it was a very lucrative position, and he'd actually gone there in order to get that job. So it was great at first, but the Sultan of Delhi was a very mercurial man and apparently quite vicious to people who he didn't trust. And he was getting more and more paranoid as the years passed. And Ibn Battuta really felt a bit in danger, particularly when a friend of his was beheaded and he was put on the list. And so he ran away for 4 months and lived in a cave until then the Sultan seemed to have a change of mood, called him back and then asked him to be the ambassador to China. And that post involved him moving with hundreds of soldiers and slaves and presents for the emperors in China.
Wow, wow.
Rubies and silks and, you know, all sorts of lovely things. But the Hindu population was at war with the Sultan, and they got harassed by bandits on the way south. They managed to repulse them. But then Ibn Battuta got separated, and he actually got captured by the bandits, nearly got murdered, managed to talk his way, escaped only in his trousers. And then to make matters worse, when he got down to the south of India, the night before they were due to sail, all the goods had been put onto three junks for the trip to China, and Ibn Battuta decided to spend the day at the mosque in prayer before starting the journey. And a big storm brewed, and the junk captains felt that they'd be safer out to sea. And when Ibn Battuta went down to the harbour, it was to learn that two of the boats had sunk, and all people had drowned, and the third junk, the captain had sailed away, eventually to be captured by pirates. So he was totally in disgrace and very nervous about reporting that back to the Sultan. So he never did go back to Delhi after that.
I'm talking about the extraordinary travels and life of Ibn Battuta, a 14th century Muslim Moroccan scholar, judge, explorer, who travelled way more widely than Marco Polo, about whom we really don't know much, and not until recently, because the translation of his travels had never been made fully into English. Pamela Watson's with us, who's explored his life and times. So did he ever get to China?
He did. He ended up going to the Maldives for about a year before travelling on to China, but he did it independently. He didn't go as the ambassador of the Sultan of Delhi. And he ended up going via today's Malaysia and then into the port of Guangzhou. China was actually outside Dar al-Islam, Islamic world, and there were no fully controlled Muslim trading cities. There were Muslim traders living in the Chinese coastal cities in their own quarters. And interestingly, I think Ibn Battuta actually was clearly in a bit of culture shock when he got to China, that he was already about 25 years into his travels when he finally arrived there. But in his writings, he talks about how taken aback he is by the customs, that they eat pigs, that they sell dogs in the market, that it's unclean. And he talks about how when he travels outside of the Muslim quarters and he meets a Muslim, it's like meeting family. And I think travellers can relate to that yes. Sometimes when it all gets a bit overwhelming, that it's really lovely to meet someone from our own country. And
he'd heard about the Great Wall of China. Did he ever see it?
No, he didn't. And this actually is he writes about a wall and it being 70 days' journey from where he was staying is what he heard, but nobody that he met had actually ever seen it. But historians actually feel that he was confused between a wall which is written about in the Quran, which was a wall built to seal in Gog and Magog, and the Great Wall. And it's a part of his travel log which has historians wondering, did he ever really make it to Beijing, which is where he claimed to get to and to hear this story. But because it's a little bit vague, there's some discussion about whether he actually made it there. But then again, Marco Polo was there and didn't mention it at all. So it seems as though perhaps it was already part of the history.
Yeah, that's true. Marco Polo didn't mention it either. No, that's true. He was a bit of a womanizer. Well, I don't know whether that's fair to call him a womanizer. He was a man of his time and availed himself frequently by the sound of it.
That's a generous way of putting it, yes. No, it's a part of him that, as a woman of the 21st century, that I don't find his finest attribute. He married 10 times, and as an Islamic scholar.
Not so many. I mean, that's less than Hollywood, but go on. Yeah.
Well, he was allowed 4 wives at one time, so he married and divorced. And, in fact, that was part of his morality, was that he felt that it was the women would not travel with him, or he didn't want them to travel with him. And so as he was leaving any place, he would divorce them. And he's quite silent about providing them with any support or for their children. But they weren't the only women that he had relationships with for his period, that as long as he was married to a woman, or he owned a woman as a slave or as a concubine, then it was okay to have sex with them. So he had children by concubines and by slaves as well. Mm. And but where it was wrong was if it was a prostitute, he frowned upon prostitution and he frowned upon extramarital sex. So, yeah, he had a few double standards.
there's so many stories to tell, aren't there? You had a great moment on the banks of the Niger River in Mali, of all places, where an old man asked about your Esprit de Battuta T-shirt. Tell us about that encounter.
Yeah, it was amazing. I'd been on a pinasse travelling from Mopti to Timbuktu on the Niger, and we stopped at this little town, Tonka, for a market. And I was hot, and I stopped at a little stall to buy a Coke and sat down on a bag of rice. And there were three gentlemen sitting having some tea. And yes, it was Haji Omar, as I learned his name was, who looked at my T-shirt, and he said, you know, in French, what's this about Esprit de Batuta, which I had written on my T-shirt. And I told him the story, and his eyes opened with astonishment, because he said, as a young man, he had been intrigued by the story of Ibn Battuta, okay, that he'd studied agriculture in Bamako, and after that had travelled for 5 years, and that he'd gone to do the Hajj, he'd gone to Mecca, but he'd also gone on to Israel and Egypt, and then when he came back, he travelled all through West Africa and Central Africa before going to his father's farm, which was about 50, 60 kilometres north of the Niger to farm. And he was an old man by now, but he'd been there since. But what was really amazing as well was that as we talked further, he said that he too had decided to travel in Ibn Battuta's spirit, not to try and perfectly replicate his journey, and that was what I was doing, it was a marvellous encounter.
You were on your way to Timbuktu, of course. Despite its mysterious and unattainable status, it's not much of a place when you get there, apparently.
Probably not at all easy to get to anymore. It's very unremarkable when you first arrive. Mm. But when I got out into the desert, that's when I felt a lot more of Timbuktu's history, both the old and the new. Back in the 90s when I was there, I travelled with a Tuareg family out into the desert and looked. They were really poor Tuaregs, so in the 1970s there'd been a big drought and they'd lost their camels and their goats, and they'd never been able to resume their nomadic way of life. And so as poor Tuaregs, they made their money close to the town, whereas there were other Tuaregs out in the city. And at that time there was a Tuareg rebellion, and the Malian army would go off into the desert to fight the Tuareg rebels. And if they made losses, then they would retaliate against the poorer Tuaregs who lived near the town. So these poor people were living in fear.
Terrible.
And it was a very moving experience to be with them. But what I found with Ibrahim and Fatimata was that when Ibrahim told me stories, it could have been stories from the 1970s, of what life was like before the drought, or he might be telling tales of, the Tuareg way of life, or he might be talking about just yesterday when there was a rumour that, there'd been a shooting up in Gundam. Mm. He made them all sound like fables, that they were from the past. And it was really quite a remarkable experience to be with them.
Just to finish, what happened to Ibn Battuta in the end? Did he die in his own bed?
We're not sure exactly when he died. It was about 1368, so he, a considerable amount of time. But he didn't travel again after returning to Fez and writing his memoirs. And what was going on at the time was that the plague had arrived. And so on his return journey from the east, he was encountering places in Damascus and then even in his hometown and in Marrakesh where the plague was rife and thousands of people were dying. And what this resulted in was the collapse of many empires, and the Silk Road and its security, which he'd been able to take advantage of in his travel. It became impossible. That the wars broke out. You had the rise of Tamerlane.
It was the end of that old world, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was the end of that old world, and in fact, it's marked the beginning of a new world, because the Portuguese then wanted to find new routes to China, and so then they embarked on their sea exploration and found the route via the Cape of Good Hope around to India, And on the way, they visited Kilwa, which was one of the places that Ibn Battuta had visited and which was a major trading centre for the Yemeni Arabs, and it was destroyed. So, you know, this arrival of the plague back in the 1347 really marked the end of this golden era of travel.
Such a remarkable story, and it just goes to show all the things that you think you know about the world. We know so little. Pamela, terrific to talk with you, and thanks for taking us through and being our guide on the travels of Ibn Battuta tonight. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.